Welcome to this little audio studio we put together for the purpose of a discussion. You are Jerome. You're a person who experienced marriage, the birth of a child, the raising of a child, and then the ending of a marriage, and now regretting that decision and trying to work to reverse that decision and bring your marriage back together. And I asked you to have a conversation so that other people who maybe are considering ending their marriage could just benefit from your experience that you see through the rear view mirror, the things that you didn't see when you were heading out into this and when you felt like that was what had to happen. So why don't you start by telling us a bit about your story?
Well, my story is that I married as a mature adult. I met a great woman in when I was in my late 30s, and she was in her middle to late 30s, and we got married. We both thought we had found the right person, and we made a beautiful life together, such as we thought best or could do best. I can see in retrospect there's a lot of ways that I was could have done a much better job of my side of the marriage. But we were, after thinking we weren't going to have any children, it looked like God didn't have that in mind for us. We kind of gave up after 3 or more years. Then we were suddenly blessed. We suddenly got to have a child on the way, and we've had this great child. We had this great experience being parents together and raising this child and having a lot of good life. But at some point, I let my desire for my own happiness and my own idea of what was important lead me to think I had to leave the marriage to make the best possible life. And now it took a few years after leaving the marriage before I realized that that was something I really did wrong by my wife and son. And now I'm working to reconcile, having learned that. So much of modernity is not like we're sold. We've been conned on many layers, many fronts, and one of them is this idea that it's, well, there's so many layers, so many areas.
So why don't you say just quickly a little bit about that book and how you found it, and that was a big turning point for you.
That book, right, that book,
So
okay,
tell the title and the author.
I found the book, okay, at first I found the first reason I found that I shouldn't have left my marriage was I found it through a church. So I went to a traditional Latin mass confession, and I learned that they couldn't confess me because I couldn't get absolution because
Still in a
I
state
was
of.
living in sin. Then I looked into the what you might call legalistic reasons for it in the church's way of thinking of things, and I found that I didn't have just cause to leave my marriage. So the first thing that made me think I had to reconcile is I think the saying from the scripture might even be, let them be reconciled. But it basically said if a man and a woman are in a situation like I was in, they just have to be reconciled to staying marriage. They can't,
Walking away.
there's no leaving, or if one had left, that didn't give them the right to spin up a new romance or a new relationship. Couldn't be a valid divorce, so there couldn't be a valid remarriage in the cases I had, the case I was in. So anyway, so that led me to realize, oh, I guess I have to reconcile. But then later, that happened to be that teaching was from the Catholics. So I was a year or two later, I was listening to a Catholic guy, Patrick Coffin, who interviewed another Catholic woman, Layla Miller. Their topic was this book that Layla had assembled from the
Testimonies.
testimony of 70 plus divorced adult children of divorce. So these were people who were grown adults, but they were still experiencing the damage and the suffering from their parents' divorce. And when I read that book and those stories multiple times, I was stricken by that was more persuasive to me than the Bible argument or the scripture argument or Jesus said it argument, is that I could see it was incontrovertibly true that those children of divorce were paying the price. Mm-hmm. They were paying for their parents' divorce, and their parents were living in a dream world,
right,
thinking that they hadn't, that everything was cool, because the children weren't even permitted to speak the truth about this. The children, in fact, had been recruited into being like emotional support systems, mm-hmm, for these divorced parents.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is sick.
Inverting the parent-child relationship.
Yeah, and just, anyway, it was just horrible. So I realized, I thought I was cool when I orchestrated my divorce, because I thought, well, our son is 18.
Mm-hmm.
Either he's almost 18 or he is 18. Well, no, these adult children, some of them are 50 years old, and they're still paying the price.
Mm-hmm.
They're paying the price. Their marriages are damaged. Their whole worldview is damaged. Their confidence is shaken. They're still wishing their parents would get back together. They're dealing with weird, strange step-granddads and step-grandmas and step-siblings. Mm. And
these complicated family trees.
Complicated family trees and complicated weddings and graduations.
That should be happy. And then you have all this things to negotiate and navigate.
And every Christmas and every holiday, every birthday. And to think that, you know, it's people pick on the boomers because they're so, well, at least not, maybe not all, but that's this related thing is that I'm in circles of younger people where contempt of boomers and hatred of boomers is kind of a part of their culture, because they see the boomers as having been so selfish. But the way this thing works, this divorce, cost of divorce being secretly imposed on the next generation, and no one's allowed to talk about it, and the next generation and the following generation are just supposed to bear it, but not rock the boat, not tell the parents that they've done this. Anyway, it's a stereotypical abuse, really. It's abusive behavior by the generation that did the divorce. I don't want to participate in that. I want to stop it before it gets any worse. I want to turn it around. I want to create a healthy root for the family tree from which the next generations can have this strength instead of this downstream craziness.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want my son to have to see his father with another woman. I don't want my son to have to see his mother with another man and go through that personally himself, or have to explain it to his children why this is, how come grandma and grandpa are with these other people. Or anyway, I want to, in my case, it isn't too far gone.
Mm-hmm.
I learned this before he had gotten married himself or started his family. So I feel like I hadn't gone too far down the road. I mean, I can see that what I'm saying is going to be hard for people who've already remarried and had more children, maybe, or otherwise gotten into a more
complex situation.
Yeah, something that's harder to fix.
Mm-hmm.
But so that's why that's why I wanted to have this conversation with you, in case it can help anyone else. You would know that I'm glad I turned back before I went further down, mm-hmm, this path of imposing the costs of my, you know, my wanting my own happiness,
mm-hmm,
making, using that. It's not fair for me to get my own happiness at the cost of my, mm-hmm, children and grandchildren's happiness. This is another thing, another reason why, you know, people are, the people I associate with, so many of them think the boomers are, you know, a bad example, is that they're willing to mortgage their children's,
mm-hmm,
future.
Right,
it's,
yeah,
kind of like that, kind of like taking out a loan that for my happiness that my children and grandchildren are going to have to pay. It's not, I don't want that to be my legacy.
Yeah, I feel like people with younger kids, I mean, even an older kid, but a younger, like an 18-year-old is still depending on their parents to find their way and how they're going to proceed in the world and figuring a lot of stuff out, needing guidance and role models. I mean, for one thing, as a role model, if you choose to just give up on trying to work things out, that kind of a scary message for any age child, because that's seen as a possibility instead of family means forever, and that there's nothing you can do about that except make it as good as possible and try to work solutions that everyone can live with. And, you know, the kids who are smaller, it really seems to me like it's very difficult to be a parent. It's very difficult to bring a child through the adolescent period, because there's so many strange pulls on young people with the internet and world and all that kind of stuff. And then at the same time, if you are ending your marriage and figuring out all this, you know, have all these things to figure out with that process, it just seems, and then even after that process, like negotiating how to share parenting with someone that you don't really get along with that well, just seems like it's putting a big target on your kids' back, because people who prey on kids, whether it's some local creep or whether it's a system that takes advantage of young vulnerable people to sell them things, to get data from them, to get them involved in unhealthy things, whatever it is, whichever kind of threat that they face, that they're just going to be more vulnerable. So, I don't know. It's not really a question, but that's if you want to say anything about that. Or.
Oh, I agree with all of that. Already in my case, I decided to turn this around like 3 years after deciding to leave is when I realized I needed to reverse that course and try and reconcile. So 3 years after deciding to leave, but only about 2 years and 2 months after actually leaving. So in my case, it took 8 months or so between the decision and the actual physically moving mm-hmm. off the same property.
Mm-hmm. Was that really contentious or difficult?
That caused a lot of that 8 months of between.
Was your son living there at that same time or no? Was he living somewhere else?
He was more or less at home. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was off at a summer camp or whatever. Yeah. Basically, he was still living at home. Anyway, that 8 months was very hard for my wife. That was very, very hard. And she's reminded me many times that how interminable and difficult that time seemed. That it took that, but we were really tangled up together, and untangling and moving out was, I don't know if I could have done any faster, but
yeah.
Anyway,
during that time, were you then not able to focus on your son, either of you, probably at the way?
Well,
you
no, we had. I mean, it seemed we thought we were doing as good as we could mm-hmm, with mm-hmm. our son. We agreed to remain the best possible co-parents and not to, you know, make it worse for our son, but to try and make it. So I don't know that we weren't focusing on him.
But I guess what I'm saying, I mean, maybe this is my bias, but if you have all these things to work out, and then if his mom is feeling all of this tumult, I think the person who feels left, it's probably more wounded and terrified and all that kind of stuff. So where would the, like, that's got to affect the emotional energy to put into helping launch this child into the world. And
it's got to. So yeah. I'm full of regret about that.
I'm not trying to make you feel bad either. No, I'm just trying to look at the impact as objectively as possible.
No doubt there was terrible impact there that in this 8 month process I'm talking about, it was 3 months in when we had the conversation with him where we told him that we were going to end the marriage, or that I was leaving the marriage. So definitely he knew for 5 months before I really could get
separated out.
Get my all my stuff out of the shared property and that sort of thing, disentangle.
And what do you think of, well, I don't want to go, if you don't want to share his thing, reaction, that's totally maybe a better idea. But I was just, I'm wondering, and you don't have to answer, if his reaction indicated or gave you any hint of what this could all mean to a child when that you found out much later with the book.
It gave a hint, mm-hmm. and I think he also tried not to show it.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
I think one of the things from the book Primal Loss that I think I saw with my own family's primal loss is there is kind of a social taboo mm-hmm. to not
tell the truth about this.
Yeah, children to try and be emotional support for their parents divorcing instead mm-hmm. of the children standing up and admitting that they don't like the idea of the divorce and they want their parents to stay together. There's some kind of strange thing where we could both see, my wife and I could both see that he was
holding back or something, or
he was taking it as a horrible blow, but at the same time he was putting up a brave face and trying to accept it as
Of that just the fact that since he's the child and you're the parents that he's not really supposed to tell you what he thinks about your actions or choices, or is it that for a lot of kids, maybe?
Maybe, but I mean, when he was younger, it was very clear that he hated it if we would fight,
uh-huh.
and it was very upsetting to him if we were having an argument or not getting along. So I don't know the answer to your question.
Yeah.
But he hadn't as a small child he hadn't been shy about. Maybe he'd be shy about telling us outright, mm-hmm. but his feelings were more obvious.
Yeah. Well, okay, a lot of people say that it's better to get divorced because we're fighting in front of the kid or kids, and that's very upsetting. So if we get divorced, then at least that's the solution to that fighting in front of the kids. What would you say to someone who said that?
Well, I would say that...
based on your experience.
That in reading, well, I don't know about reading, but having read the Primal Loss, which I'm going to keep pitching as a better source than just me, because it's over 70 different people and their stories,
and
so different families. I would say it looked like in the case of 15 or 20% of the adult children of divorce, they did say it was better that their parents got divorced. So there are real life stories mm-hmm. on that kind of order of magnitude, mm-hmm. you know, a fifth or a sixth or mm-hmm. whatever, where whatever the parents fighting or the problems before, it seemed like the divorce was overall better mm-hmm. than not.
But that could include like abuse, alcoholism,
all those
gambling
things.
Addiction, where you're, you know, getting rid of the family's resources.
Right. Yeah, all of those cases together added up to about 1 in 6.
Yeah.
Or maybe 1 in 5.
So whatever the problem
But the other 80% or 85%, whatever, of the people were wishing it had never happened. Mm-hmm. And we're still, and a shockingly high percentage of them, like almost all of them, were wishing their parents could somehow get back together.
Uh-huh.
So that mm-hmm. that to me, and I could see that in my own case when I read those stories and then I looked at my particular family, I could see it was 100%
mm-hmm.
that he would be happier and everything would be better if I could undo this leaving
mm-hmm.
and reconcile somehow, even though I knew it was going to be hell to pay
mm-hmm.
because it wasn't like, oh, welcome back, honey.
Mm-hmm, of course. So wounded soul there.
No, there was I was going to be reminded of mm-hmm. my wrongness and reasons why I couldn't be trusted now.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to have to deal with like operating from a very
low credibility score.
Yeah, right. Yeah, my credit score was not looking good, and it wasn't going to be easy to fix, and I was going to have to eat all of that crow and just accept that as the price of my lesson of having done what I did. I mean, I did it. I can't undo it. I have to deal with it. But I'm much happier dealing with it now, having made a clear commitment to myself that I am committed to reconciling with all, putting all of my possible effort to reconcile, and I'm committed to not taking other partners going forward, that if I have to be single, if I can never get the reconciliation to work, still I'm not going to
find someone else,
right? Go out with another woman, or even though I did do that, and now that's part of the
damage,
part of the damage is that I do have to live with that with that reputational and spiritual
wound,
burden, that I did that and made that, made it worse in that way too. And that was another lesson that was very clear, was I did take a girlfriend, and I remember my son figuring out that I had taken a girlfriend, and what I saw in his
reaction,
and I'll never forget it. It's not worth it. It's
not, and worth you didn't it. Think that would be a big deal to him, or
I,
what did you
well,
think?
I think I was lying to myself.
Yeah.
I think part of me believed it was going to be fine, but then another part of me was hiding it, which meant that probably I knew
hint,
that it wasn't fine,
or at least a good chance. Yeah.
And then when he saw it, it was incontrovertible that it was
not fine.
It was a disaster, right? And I mean, I can only imagine how much more expensive to his life it would be if I had continued in it anyway. And taken the stance that most divorced people do, that, hey, suck it up. You just gotta get used to your new stepmom here, or your new, or the fact that your mom has boyfriends now, or your dad has a new girlfriend or wife or whatever.
And who knows how long this one will last?
Right, yeah. Who knows how long this one will last? And how do you like your new stepsister who just got to meet when you're both in your 20s.
Right. And
isn't it great, at family dinners?
Right.
How does it all work?
Well, it looked good on the Brady Bunch.
Thank God I never saw that show, but I'm sure that Hollywood could sell us anything.
Yeah. I'm just interested. I think we might have spoken about this, but just this idea of the way we're sold, that if you, do everything for yourself, that's the way to have the best life, and put yourself first, and make sure no one treats you this or that or whatever, as opposed to living in service to others and the joy of all that. And so just the idea that even if it doesn't work out again, like if your wife isn't able to build her trust again, just trying to live in service to your marriage and your son.
Oh, I can, even whether she accepts it or not, I can still live in service. That's not a problem. So that part is, to me, it's gotten much clearer and cleaner to now have this vision. So I don't worry about that.
More joyous than the other?
Oh, much better. Much better. Because now I see what the other thing, I tell you, it was like, picture like holding your child underwater and not letting him breathe. You don't want to be doing that.
Mm-mm.
I feel better now that I'm not damaging, I'm not further damaging my beloved child
or
children. Right. Once I realized I was harming them, why would I continue in that harm?
Right.
It doesn't make any sense. So I'm glad I found out before, like I got remarried or some other complication, that would have been way worse, because then other people would be suffering too. Already I caused suffering to another woman that became my girlfriend, and she was very heartbroken when I told her I can't
continue,
be with you anymore, and just kind of dropped her without it really being her fault. And that's another
wound,
another crime in a way that I committed, or another way I damaged somebody else's life unnecessarily.
I think it's really brave of you to face these things, because there's so much in our culture that just encourages and permits these things that damage our ability to be close to the people that we love the most. I've been reading about the ability of internet gadgets and apps to steal our attention and focus away from everything in our real life, including, of course, the people that we love and the relationships that are the most important and meaningful. So I think that's pretty cool that you're willing to do it and share it with others to help them to live a better life and a more pleasing to God life and a more joyous life. I think it's through suffering that we can purify our soul, and whatever mistakes we've made and bad choices and bad paths, that God loves us and there's a way forward, and that we can work to heal the harm and commit to sin no more. Have that actually mean something, have our words mean something. God never gives up on us, which is pretty lucky.
Yeah, we're really lucky that way. We're really lucky that way. And I love that, yeah, it's very helpful to have God on our side and to have this perspective of someone with faith that has all this system of sense-making that makes it all clear and easy. But even if I didn't have my faith, even if I was still just a totally rationalist person trying to optimize, even if I was just a rationalist person trying to optimize my own happiness, once I learned the way I'm imposing costs on my offspring by pursuing another family situation or love relationship than with the mother of my child or children, I would still go for the reconciliation. Mm-hmm. So even though it was our apostolic faith that brought us together, mm-hmm. you and I, to be able to even have this conversation, mm-hmm. even though I heard this through Catholic circles, I think even the agnostic, totally rationalist version mm-hmm. of Jerome would have been persuaded to try and reconcile mm-hmm. and make that the priority. So for me, it was more like, in fact, it's kind of backwards in a way, in that when I saw the primal loss evidence, it was, for me, it was more like, here's more proof that the church has it right.
Right.
But it isn't that the proof was, this primal loss stories are true because it matches the church. Mm-hmm. It's more like the primal loss stories are,
maybe I need to reconsider this more carefully.
Yeah, or evidence that I could have. In fact, I realized, if I had just stayed in the faith, it would have protected me from this all along.
Right.
Even though I thought the faith was maybe for intellectual lightweights or whatever.
Too damaged by the flaws of the humans that are carrying it out.
But it would have protected me, yeah. because they did give me the right answer, even if.
But I still think that if you were just an agnostic, then your love for your son, would that really be enough to make you not choose your own selfish interests and happiness?
Yes, because because the kind of agnostic I was, and maybe because I was formed Catholic, mm-hmm. they say, you know, the formation is everything, or very important. But when I left the church, as I said before, I didn't leave my ideas of right and wrong. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. My ideas of right and wrong are deeper. I think they're deeper. I think my conscience,
some social programming,
it isn't given to me by the church. I think my conscience was given to me directly by mm-hmm. God,
right.
when he created me. And my conscience says, okay. you would never harm your son's life. Mm-hmm. That couldn't, you could never be happier that way. Mm-hmm. No matter what you thought, you know, if mm-hmm. you matter whether you thought you were in some kind of, you know, paradise mm-hmm. in heaven with 72 virgins or whatever, it would not be better mm-hmm. than it wouldn't be worth harming mm-hmm. your child.
And then your idea of caring about the future impacts people you don't even know, your grandchildren, they don't exist yet, so you don't want to harm your future progeny.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to harm them, and I want to live.
But I mean, I think some people could be convinced to not care about that.
Oh, right. But I think that's a sign of how far we've fallen, how corrupted our society has become.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, well, I mean, my maps are kind of, or my explanations might be a little dark, but I think we've been, our countries and whatever have been ruled by people that are full on psychopaths for a long time. And they're making psychopathic non-empathy, empathy incapable kind of calculations the norm. They're training other people to be like them. But it's not the way I naturally would be. And it's not the way my mother was ever. I mean, my mother was not, my parents wouldn't have ever consciously wrecked our future. They knew they were passing on a torch. This is a torch. I mean, this is the real family fortune, the family legacy. That's the real inheritance. So anyway, so now I see that I would have been, I've always been disgusted when I see that those bumper stickers on the giant RVs that they used to see. I don't know if they're still out there, but there would be this $200,000 or $500,000 RV with the bumper sticker. We're spending our children's inheritance. But it's worse than spending the inheritance. It's like actually vampire. It's sucking their energy. It's to give me, oh, but I need it. I want a new lover. I want a new.
But in your case, you left partly because you were trying to be true to certain principles. You found someone late as a secondary effect.
Yeah, that was years later.
You weren't leaving for someone else.
No, I was. I mean, okay, I was leaving because I wanted to live forever, and I thought I could do it. And I know about the power of the placebo effect, and that means I know about the nocebo effect. And I thought, if I stay with this woman I married before I got any of these ideas, she had no idea she was buying into this, that now if I stayed with her, the nocebo effect, the fact that she wouldn't do what I thought we had to do to defeat aging, meant that she was voting no confidence, and that would undermine my chances of success to be with someone who her position was, I get to choose my own way of dealing with aging, and I don't have to do it your way. And I just want to eat vegetables and take walks in nature and focus on the beauty in the world. So, yeah, that reasoning was, I can't win if I'm with somebody or my chances of winning are reduced if I'm around someone who thinks I'm doing it wrong, who thinks I'm not going to win, thinks my plan is stupid. So I left and I went to be with people who thought my plan was smart, and be
that
around
the plug. Yeah.
We could lift each other up in this mutual effort, but so that was a weird reason.
Yeah, but it's interesting because it's kind of hints at the other thing tugging apart at divorce is feminism. And I was raised on Free to Be You and Me and everything, and from the Ms. Foundation. So I was definitely, that was in practically the mother's milk. My mom didn't know. She was letting us listen to this over and over. So we're being influenced. But
this, what was this?
This was a...
did you say the Ms.
album,
something?
An album that the Ms. Foundation put out.
Oh.
And like Diana Ross and Alan Alda and all these stars. I think Michael Jackson was even in a video for it. And it was about getting rid of gender stereotypes. And it was all about, you know, happily ever after meant the woman went this way and the man went and off and did something else and then might see each other someday and they might not. Kind of a cold, lonely ending of the story. But, you know, they had their own independence and they could do whatever they wanted. And so there's sort of this idea that the culture sold. It is a very difficult, as a woman, the idea that, like, you're supposed to follow your husband. Sometimes I think my ideas are better, or I've looked at it, certain things more carefully or whatever. But from the point of view of preserving the marriage, if we did kind of have that habit where the woman could make all the cases that they wanted and lobby and everything, but at the end of the day, you know, when there's a dispute, you just kind of say, okay, that's what we're doing. like the tiebreaker, basically, that might protect marriages. And I think what you were into was not great, and it would be kind of sad to see, like, say you were getting vaccinated and you wanted your spouse to get vaccinated, and because she's the woman, she has to go along with what you say. That's very bitter pill to swallow. But at the same time, maybe that's part of the cost to protect marriages.
I think it is. So, I mean, when I look back at what was wrong, so many things were wrong because we lived in a poison world and we're being fed poison.
Many different kinds.
All different kinds. But yes, so another reason that I left is that, or decided to leave the marriage, is when I had gotten married, I was a feminist, and I consciously chose an equalitarian marriage, mm-hmm. and there was this no idea that the man would lead, and mm-hmm. our marriage vows were very clear, and my wife reminded me of them mm-hmm. very well, that we were to support one another in our highest potential, together and separately. Mm-hmm. We had vowed things like that mm-hmm. in our vows, and we weren't, there was no idea in those vows that she would be submitting mm-hmm. to my leadership or mm-hmm. that I would necessarily be leading. We were co-equal. We kept separate finances. We married relatively late in life, right at the last mm-hmm. moment, really, for being able to have children. Mm-hmm. And we were already used to running our own,
mm-hmm. yeah.
being mm-hmm. our own masters. Mm-hmm. And we could get along fine together, or we could get along separately. And we could vacation together or separately. And anyway, we had very little community property. Mm-hmm. We were mostly in our own property already, which helped make it easier to end the marriage too. But anyway, mm-hmm. the point being, but near the end of this time before when I chose to leave, I was no longer a feminist. I had been persuaded by the people I was reading and my own high opinion of my, I have a high opinion of my opinion. So that's one of my big problems.
I think we all struggle with that. So we're encouraged to do that, I think.
So I had gotten this idea that a man should lead, and I tried to take charge, and mm-hmm. I was actually insisting that I take charge of the management of the aging process. Mm-hmm. So that's why I got that idea stuck in my head, so I wasn't willing to let her run her own relationship with aging, because I said, you're gonna just, why are you gonna get old and die on me? I can handle this. Let me take the oars, let me guide mm-hmm. the boat mm-hmm. here, and I'll keep us from going over the waterfall. Your plan is just to drift along and let this known waterfall of mm-hmm. of what's called senescence, the planned destruction of the human body after 60 or 40 to just destroy us. So let me take charge of this. I've got this. But anyway, so that idea of wanting to lead and being told no, you mm-hmm. know, we had a deal. We worked this out. You can't change
midstream.
You
right.
can't change the contract. I mean, I wouldn't have married you if I thought you were going to
be like this. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I'm my own woman here. I get to do what I want. Now I see that all that is in the small stuff category compared to the real union, which is the child. Mm-hmm. You see that this idea, again, that the two become one, we are one in our son. Mm-hmm. That is the real fruit. And I have to prioritize that, or I ought to, if I don't want to be a villain, mm-hmm. if I want to be a man I could look up to, and mm-hmm. I'm very driven by that sort of thing, mm-hmm. wanting to be honorable, mm-hmm. wanting to do the right thing. I couldn't live with myself but in retrospect, but I'll advise my son, don't get an equalitarian marriage. Mm-hmm. Get with a woman who is willing to let you lead, or you could decide to be you could do some kind of upside down marriage. I don't recommend it. But the idea that there should be a clear
chain of command.
I think there should be, there should be a buck stops here position. And I think it's that men are more natural. That was part of how we're made is that we thrive in that role compared to being, and that women are more adapt, they're more adapted to be able to submit even though they don't like it necessarily. And maybe they aren't all, and I'm not, I don't want to speak for others, but I just knew in my case, even though...
Well, it sounds very vague when you say submit, and I must say, yeah, it doesn't sound very appealing as a woman, but the way I see it is just putting the union above any particular decision means that if it means staying together and staying, you know, on the same page, and somebody has to compromise, then that could be me. Because, I don't know, I mean, especially when it's about, I mean, it does help a little bit when it's about things that the man might have more experience with or practical, you know, knowledge about, so.
Yeah, of course, if it's in his area of expertise. So, like in the case of my wanting to take charge of managing the aging process, I said, hey, you know, this is, I'm an expert in this.
Right.
You're not. So I should drive through this part, these rapids or whatever. I should navigate these rapids. Or in the case, but like you mentioned earlier, the vaccine thing could happen where one gets forced to take it and the other doesn't want. Well, like that would have, if I had been in charge, no one would have gotten the shots.
And you'd do whatever it
took to avoid it. But if it had been the other way and I had been having to go along, then I would have had to take the shots, which I'm really grateful that I wasn't.
And then how many families were put in this terrible situation where one person wanted to, one person thought it was, you know, something to be avoided like the plague, and then that's a huge stress to put on a marriage.
A huge, and then, but it's even a piece, I'll give another reason of how the worst stories I've heard like that. That's bad enough. Imagine being in a marriage and having to sort that out. But imagine being divorced and having to sort that out. And one part, and the children are, it's put in the hands of the courts to decide which parent gets to have their way.
Right.
And I have seen the worst, to me, that's been the worst outcome is to watch, especially to watch the suffering of the parent who's trying to protect the child from this injection that the other parent thinks is good. But the parent who's trying to protect the child thinks this thing is scary. You know, I don't feel the safe about this. Anyway, that, and then have that forced. I mean, it's even worse if I can't imagine any of those cases where if they had still been married and had to sort it out, it could ever have been worse than when the one parent with the power of the court and the government and the law just basically use that child as a pincushion for their,
well, they just,
their
they
high,
have...
yeah, they were super confident, you know, they're like, oh yeah. In fact, I mean, I knew of one case where the father pleaded and did everything he could, and the mother still had the legal power, so she did it, and he begged her, well, at least ask them to aspirate, which will at least prevent accidentally injecting it into a vein, is what the aspiration technique does. Because they're theoretically intramuscular, but you actually hit veins when you go intramuscular a certain percentage of the time. Anyway, that this weird divorced mother wouldn't even give the father that.
So that's another whole problem, that it's really hard to predict how the other partner is going to handle divorce. I mean, that's not to be coercive, but I think it is a very human thing that can happen, that people end up using the child as a pawn or a means to extract revenge. And so if that could be avoided...
Right. So that is so...
I mean, it's wrong for someone to do that, of course, to a child, but that is it does happen.
I mean, I'm sad to say I've known of it happening. It's terrifying. There was a period when I went to men's groups a lot, when I was trying to keep my marriage together, actually, before all this craziness. But the stories I've heard there from men who've been through whatever they call that kind of divorce, where it's not good, where the parties are...
Acrimonious
divorces, yeah. Men who've been through them. And
courts.
And I've heard some secondhand stories, not from women, about similarly, I suppose. I know it can be really bad. But yeah, so that's another unknown risk that it could be much worse than one thinks, because I hadn't thought of what you said, Amy, that it's hard to predict how the other party will handle it. So we go in, we're thinking about how we're going to handle it, but we don't know what they might do.
What I think, if we really love Jesus and are so humbled by the sacrifice of Jesus and the love of Jesus and love of God for us, that it really has to be love. That's like our first tool, our first response, our first way of being in the world. And when COVID started, I knew it was something weird and dishonest and like this huge con, and all my neighbors, like I was scared everyone's crazy because they're all just falling for this and no one's standing up. But I said, I don't know what this is about, but I just know that they try to make people hate each other and divide each other. So I just knew, I just committed that whatever they're going to do, they're not going to make me hate anybody. I refuse to let them make me hate anyone. So I've tried to, it's difficult, and it's not maybe my personality type, but I try to be loving even in the face of people that I think are doing really terrifying things and dangerous things and harmful things, murderous things. And I've tried to, with my family members that have strong disagreement, to try to be in love even when we're really disagreeing. It hasn't always worked, but God's will, I mean, for the most part it has. So I guess that's the big thing, that for those of us who want Christ to be the center of our life and are just so grateful for creation, for the sacrifice of Christ, it seems like trying to figure out how to put love first, even though at times we can get distracted or not do that. But I think that is a really important thing to try to do and could help. I don't know.
Oh, it would certainly help. Would totally help. So anyone who can keep that in mind will avoid a lot of mistakes. A lot of them.
Yeah, there are, you know, really important issues that you can have a disagreement over. And if you put love of the other person first, it seems what we're called to do. It's very difficult at times, but it seems what we're called to do.
Yeah. So in a marriage with children, I think it's not this saying love of the other person. It's the other people. Because I think the whole family is one. It's kind of an entity.
I agree, but I also think, like what happened in your case, you never lost your deep sense of love, even for your wife. I think you loved her the whole time, but you also never lost sight of the fact that you love your son. I think it's easier to remember that you love your kids, even if you don't realize how your actions aren't squaring with that love, than it is that you have to love your spouse that's driving you nuts at that time.
Right.
I think
that's a good point.
Kind of challenging, and or anyone, other family members, siblings, parents, parents-in-law. You know, this can be really, really hard. If they have really terrible views or have done really hurtful things or have left a trail of harm from childhood in the person that we're marrying, if their parents had harmed them or something like that, it can be very, very hard to forgive and to love, to lead with love. But I feel like that's what we're called to do, and that when we do that, if nothing else, God sees it, is how I feel about it. Like, you know, mm-hmm. It's like you just have to try, even though it might feel really hard for you and it might not even work for the other person. They might not trust it or whatever. It might not break the impasse, but I do feel like God sees that, and that's a way to give glory to God.
Yeah, I agree. God sees it, and it's a way to give glory to God. That's true. But boy, you threw some hard ones in there, Amy, so I'm having to think about some of them. There's still some people I'm not even trying to lead with love with. I'm just trying to keep from crossing paths with them or having to have any relations with them at all. So
yeah.
So,
but, you know, when you marry someone, you do become part of their family and they become part of your family, and you do have to try to figure out how to, you know, they're made in the image and likeness of God, like everybody else. And they're sacred. God loves them as much as they love
I get it, Amy. I just hadn't.
Anybody else?
I hadn't been willing to turn over some of those stones. and here you caught me. You know, I was kind of in denial of the layers here that I may have to face.
But it's hard. I mean, everybody has to face these things. For the child or the children, that's part of their family. The in-laws, that's part of their family. You know, I have a difficult situation with one sibling out of four, but that's really hurtful because my kids haven't really hung out with his kids very much, and that's really sad. And so I want to repair things with that sibling, but very difficult. I thought I'd wait for Trump to be over because everyone was so Trump derangement syndrome and just so animated and trigger happy. But then COVID happened and... So, like, when will be the right time to try to...
Well, they go from one derangement syndrome to the next.
So, like, and we have very strong different politics, so I just thought I would try to wait until those kind of things, but that might never happen. So how can I lead with love there? I don't know. So I'm not judging here, trust me. These are hard, hard challenges. Even in marriages that are not... on the edge of breaking up, there's still a lot of challenges and work to be done and difficult moments that we have to try to remind ourselves that love is the highest calling and service is a great joy and serving our children is what we owe our children, what was done for us by our forebears. So I don't know. It's my take.
Yeah, I'm sold on it in principle. Maybe I can... manifest a little more of it in reality when it comes to some challenging...
Well, you already did a lot in trying to reverse course, which a lot of people wouldn't do. So I give you a lot of credit for that. I think you have a lot of courage and be an inspiration for others.
Yeah, but it is humbling to see this huge blind spot that I've... I guess I still am pretty good at deluding myself when it comes to
things
I don't want to look at.
One of the ways that I try to be gracious to people that drive me nuts or think things that I think are terribly dangerous and hurtful and even murderous, many times they don't even realize it, and just the way we've all been programmed. And so if you can forgive yourself for the ways that you were manipulated and fell for things, even if you did harm others, you do have to try to heal that harm that you did to others. You do have to be sincerely sorry and seek confession and forgiveness, I believe. But at the same time, you have to have compassion that they are, you know, certain people seem to be very bent on enticing others into dark places and into being weak and, I think, into an enslaved status. So there are very sophisticated operations meant to ensnare us and weaken us and call us to sin. And so we have to be gracious about getting snagged up here and there when it happens to us and when it happens to others. And most people, I think most of the time, don't really intend to be hurting any of us. Most of the mistakes I can think of, I wasn't at heart trying to hurt someone. But you see that sin does hurt people. And so it is important to try to think deeply about what sin is and why we're taught what we're taught by the church, so that we can be less harmful and be more living in love and gratitude for God. So, I don't know.
Yeah, well, thank you, Amy. That's been here. You gave me some blessings I can take away from this and rethink or reapproach some issues I hadn't really looked at. It's good.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your courage in speaking out. And I don't know how widely this will be shared, but
well, we'll see. We'll see if anyone even cares about it. But it's been good to talk about. You helped me realize some things I didn't know, and I would love it if what I learned can help anyone else. That would be good. I do think this isn't talked about enough, that our culture makes it look better than it is, the divorce thing.
Yeah, I think they do that on purpose.
Yeah,
I was wondering about if the way the detransitioners, they get deplatformed and silenced and censored. And I was wondering if people who talk about these kind of things get deplatformed or silenced or censored. But I guess in the old days, in the early days, you know, that's a kind of a modern way of suppressing opinions. But it would be what was elevated in the mainstream media and what was not. You know, how come there wasn't a heartfelt, I don't know, Good Times or... I don't know, I'm trying to think of a show where they got divorced, and that, you know, they talked about all these things long into the future or whatever, you know. It was just people got used to the idea that, you know, oh, mom's remarried or dad has serial partners, like that 3.5 men. I guess that dad was just totally crazy, and I didn't watch the show too much. But anyway, the point is that's how they would suppress the unwanted view of really seeing how important keeping marriages together is, and supporting other people's marriages and protecting our own marriages. and encouraging children to see the value of it for their future lives, all that.
They've been waging a psychological and spiritual war on us for
in this country,
at least three
100,
generations.
Yeah.
at least 100 years.
120 years, something like that.
120 years, right, easily. And arguably thousands of years.
Yeah.
But it's good. We're coming to a turning. You know, there's a turning. There's a rising...
consciousness, yeah.
Rising consciousness.
I think so.
Well, thank you, Amy, for inviting me to join you in this conversation.
Thanks for being willing to share all these very personal things. And I know you do it out of love for your family and for others. And God sees. Thanks.
You're welcome, Amy. Thank you.